Welcome back to In Focus with David Coletto. I'm David Coletto. Now, it's a cliche to say that the pandemic has had a profound impact on everyone's lives. There's no doubt about that. But no sector in Canada has been as deeply affected and hardest hit as live music. In the span of days, concerts big and small were postponed and canceled around the world. Musicians, technicians, agents, venue owners and staff, and others who depend on live music saw their livelihoods disappear. Throughout 2020 and 2021, I worked closely with Music Canada, the national association representing the world's largest record labels, to understand how the pandemic was affecting and impacting live music. We surveyed Canadians on their intentions to return to live music, how well they understood the pandemic's impact, and their desire for government support for the sector. We also surveyed artists and found that not only has the pandemic eliminated or severely restricted their primary income source, but it's had a devastating impact on their emotional and mental health. Like most Canadians, I want live music to be there when this pandemic is over. And so I'm delighted that Music Canada CEO Patrick Rogers and the president and CEO of the Canadian Live Music Association, Aaron Benjamin, agreed to join me to discuss what needs to happen to save the sector and get live music back on its feet once this is all over. This is about protecting Canadian culture, art, and music, and in my view, it's not a question of whether government should step up to support the industry, but the scale needed to get the sector and artists through it. Here's my discussion with Aaron Benjamin and Patrick Rogers. Well, Aaron Benjamin and Patrick Rogers, thank you so much for joining the podcast.
Nice to be here.
Nice to be here, David.
Let's start with, I guess, level setting for everybody on, everybody knows. We did some polling with you, Patrick. Everybody knows the pandemic has devastated the live music industry in Canada. But Aaron, maybe I'll start with you and you can give us a sense of just how devastating the impact's been in different ways.
Sure. Oh, where to start? Let's start with the revenue loss. So it's March 2020. So that was last year because we're in a new year that looks a lot like the old year. March 2020, you know, complete full stop of the sector. We've been saying, you know, 92% overall average revenue loss, and this would be stakeholders like, you know, small live music clubs, venues, performing arts centers, of course, festivals, and the entire ecology that, basically the supply chain that makes these live events go. So I'm sure we'll come back to artists in a bit, but, you know, we're looking at everyone from sound and lights production, all the freelance crew, contractors, the rooms themselves, you know, from box office to backstage. And it's so, you know, everything in addition to layoffs and furloughs, trying to pivot and coming up with all kinds of creative ways of moving money through that supply chain. And of course, we've run into a myriad of restriction issues, and depending on what province you're in, they look a little bit different. But in addition to the total stoppage, we're losing permanently a huge chunk of our cultural infrastructure. Unfortunately, just an inability for people to keep going, despite cobbling together relief measures and in rare instances, sector specific support.
And I think that's an important point. Is whereas hospitality, food service has been similarly devastated, their ability to pivot, I hate that word, but to pivot and to offer delivery or alternative products or services to their clientele allows many of them to get through this. That's not the case with a venue, for example, right? Like there were some, I know, efforts to try to do some streaming, which also got shut down and other ways, but you know, it's not like you can take that space and use it for anything else and try to find another revenue stream. Is that right?
Pretty much. I mean, sure, there are some of our members who would be renting out their facility, for example, to film and television production companies who can shoot
Right.
a film for future broadcast. In some cases, our members may have been able to leverage an existing or grow a patio space outdoors. Of course, that's not happening right now. Maybe they were able to sell alcohol with some of the changes of in the legislation around alcohol purchase. But broadly speaking, no, because and part of the challenge is even with some different examples I might be able to share with you, the math simply doesn't work. So, bleeding money that they don't have simply wasn't an option for many of them.
So Patrick, Music Canada commissioned my firm Abacus to track public opinion throughout the pandemic. We did three surveys of the public. First, before we get into some of the sort of not highlights, because there's not really a lot of highlights, a lot of the findings, what's Music Canada's in your mind role in this, and why are you as an organization and your members taking such an active role in helping, keep live music alive?
Yeah, thanks for that, David. I mean, Music Canada, we are the trade association for the major labels, so Sony, Warner, and Universal. And so we're their reps, but we're also partners to the rest of the music industry, like with people like Erin and her members. And we're also advocates for the community as a whole. And so COVID has really tested all of those relationships. We're now, everybody says it's a year, but I always go back to the fact that, Tom Hanks Day is the day before the Junos get canceled, right? Like it really has a day one, day zero effect on the music industry. And so we came to you, David, at the beginning, around a year ago. I mean, it's probably right bang on, to find out how when people were going to go back. That was the first question we wanted answered. Because a year ago, we thought we were going to be here for a little while. And we wanted to know if there was going to be any drag. And actually, our work with you was fundamental in our understanding and our advocacy going forward that, medical concerns aside, this was going to be a much longer way back even then. And that was thanks to the hard facts and the hard numbers that you were able to generate for us. And that was a real, oh my gosh moment, when we saw how concerned people were about transmission, how concerned people were not about their own habits, but the habits of others, and how they thought transmission was happening back then. And so that was really tough, but the bright side and the first thing that came up in our research with you was this ever-growing sense that even then, 2 months in, people missed live music. People were looking forward already to going back to a festival, to a to a club, to a venue. And that was really big. I mean, we're thrilled we did that work, and then we did it again in the summer and then the fall, just to sort of check in with people as things became clearer. We're really happy we did that.
And then the most recent survey we did in 2021 actually looked at, and we'll talk more about what role governments play in helping the sector, get through it and then rebound and recover. But I think that, the research we did this year showed, as I said at the top, almost every Canadian understood the impact. This was not like you didn't have to say very much for people to see the connection between this pandemic and its impact on live music. But a deeper, and this is, I want to talk about, music and art, and its emotional power in politics and in public policy, because people genuinely worried that, yeah, okay, well, maybe if they're, they'd be really disappointed if their local music venue shut down permanently, right? That's a personal effect. But there was this broader worry that, and understanding that this would be a long-term thing, that Canadian culture, the future of music, our ability to encourage young people and not so young people to take up performing and seeing it as a calling and an art and a lively and a business that they could make it. And people were really worried about that. So I think that to me was also this demonstration that you don't see from other sectors when we do polling, right? People don't have the same kind of emotional connection to other sectors like they do for music and art. And so for Aaron, you know, in your advocacy work, and Patrick, please chime in as well. Does that connect with political leaders? Do they see the power that music has because it's so emotional and it's so widespread? I think Patrick, in our survey, we had like over 80% of Canadians say they either love or like music. Like it's almost universal, which I'm still wondering who are the 15% who say they don't like music. And we'll maybe push them to the side for a moment, but nonetheless, it's a universal thing, right? Aaron, you know, how does that affect, you know, the advocacy for the sector and how you communicate, you know, for your members to these political leaders who clearly, you know, they're getting lots of asks and requests for support and help.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think if we look at our campaign that we've been running called For the Love of Live, which we launched with a great boost from that most recent public opinion research that we're just speaking about on so February 9th, we went to the industry to start talking about sharing live music memories with fans and really starting to get people just like asking them to take a moment, think about live music and then post something and make that actual connection. And I think that our industry felt really, really inspired by what we saw. What we saw in the beginning of that campaign was a landslide of love from Canadians on all sides of industry and fans, right? I mean, right across the country, people reconnecting, sharing their favorite, you know, memories and moments and all the things. And then a couple of weeks ago, we were able to take all of that sort of momentum that we generated through the beginning of the campaign and sort of focus people into a bit of a letter writing situation, asking government as a result of this, what I think was a really heightened awareness, the amplification that the front end of the campaign was able to create, and ask them to help us remind government that with some support, we'll be able to, some of at least more companies and organizations will be able to make it to wherever this finish line is. And so I think that the power of that emotional connection really reinforced for some folks what their maybe responsibility was even to this particular community. And not only will I miss it, you know, I don't want my local live music venue to go away, but I care about my story being told by artists. I care about those connections that I've had, whether it's with recorded music or live music. I care about the experience, my own memories, and those of my children, perhaps. And so as a result, we've seen over 30,000 letters sent to government in the last couple of weeks. And I know that this podcast is being shared on Budget Day, and hopefully it'll have an impact. But regardless of the budget and the fight, sort of, you know, the, whatever the outcomes of this advocacy work is, it was a really, I think, incredibly motivating reality for the live music industry to see so many people respond on their behalf. Very moving. And hopefully, I think in the long term, we'll have reinforced or maybe entrenched the value of what our industry actually provides and creates for Canadians.
And Patrick, you know,
David,
go ahead, Patrick.
I would just say that, you know, I think what the last 13 months have shown is, you know, the music industry's sort of once in a generation ability to come together and get sort of beyond trade associations and acronyms and get into the stories of artists and guitar techs and venue owners and sort of each person in their role in the system. You know, government understands a little bit the stakeholders that they give grants to as part of different arts and culture programs, but there aren't a lot of people who truly understand the experience of the emerging artist or the up and coming artist and what that means. And, you know, I think with some of the work that we've done on CERB and with some of the work that we did on, you know, for instance, making sure that royalty checks didn't interfere with CERB payments is probably one of the better things Music Canada and others took part in this year in terms of like concrete effect on day-to-day lives of our friends in the community. And you know, that's a really big piece to mm-hmm. to all of this. And you know, being a lobbyist for the music industry is a lot better than being a lobbyist for other industries most of the time. And this was an opportunity to take advantage of that.
And you know, speaking of artists, we haven't really spoken a lot about them. We, as part of the research we did with you, Patrick, you know, I had both the privilege and it was a heartbreaking moment, you know, doing a focus group with 12 artists in different types of music, different levels, you know, some successful, some starting out, and really hearing, you know, their stories. This was early on in the pandemic. And we did another survey of artists again earlier this year. And one stat that just, you know, continues to shock me is artists performed 5 times fewer shows in 2020 than in a typical year. And for this year, and again, the uncertainty of this is what makes this most difficult. 64% had no bookings at all. And this comes on the heels of almost all of them saying, I make my living off performing, right? So, and again, most Canadians, I don't know if most policymakers understand that, is just how important the live is to the music part of their lives, right? And so, you know, Patrick and Aaron, I guess, what are you hearing from artists today as they sort of look at this third wave in the face and maybe some optimism around vaccinations? You know, Patrick, what's your sense of the artist community in Canada on where this is going?
Well, I think the biggest question is just the uncertainty of it all. I mean, we've already touched on it a little bit, but when you go back and think about what we thought about, you know, 6 weeks ago, 6 months ago, it really becomes so hard. You know, these are people who book tours, who have a plan, who map things out, who are trying to build one step at a time. And as the medically required decisions of government pull the rug out from under them each time, the sort of near panic and also just sort of gut crushing loss is very hard to get by. And you know, I think you see it as well in many of Aaron's members who are suffering from just not knowing when they'll be able to open the door. These things are all very closely connected.
So all this evidence we've got, you know, industry data, undoubtedly clear, public support, feedback from artists, venues, others in the industry who say they need help and this is not going to be, you know, an easy recovery. What do you feel, I mean, what are you asking government for? Maybe you can share, like, how does public policy and the public purse really play a role in this? And how do you feel government's responded so far, I guess is a question. I'm really curious to hear from you because, you know, I hear announcements and I see lots of great support, you know, from the provincial government, for example, some stuff from the federal government, but is it nearly enough to deal with, you know, the long-term impact that this might have on the sector?
Go ahead, Patrick.
I'll just give sort of a general overview. I mean, I'm very supportive of a lot of the initial into the fire response of governments at all levels. CERB was a very, once the details were ironed out and the recovery benefit, you know, sort of took over, it proved to be an incredibly important lifeline for many in the community. And it didn't matter if you were an artist or a guitar tech or a waiter at a venue, like, or a bartender at a venue, none of that stuff sort of mattered and it equaled out. And I think a lot of that was really good in that, you know, I know that there isn't a playbook labeled in the minister's office somewhere, sort of like, you know, here's break glass for when global pandemic comes, like that. That's not there. And so I think folks at many levels did a really good job on it. I'm
you know, thrilled by the government of Ontario's announcement and Minister McLeod's announcement about a month ago now for support for Abacus, the music industry's benevolent fund that helps artists in the community who find themselves in hard times and serves, or COVID is obviously a massive time for that. But the most general ask, and Aaron's got really specific ones because her people need help right now, so I'll get out of the way. But, you know, what am I looking for on budget day? I'm looking for a recognition that no one knows when this will truly be capital O, capital V, capital E, capital R over. And until we are able to participate in the mass gatherings that we previously participated in, until people are able to move freely, there's going to need to continue to be some level of support, some willingness from government to think about these issues and to look at them carefully for those who are most directly affected by the closures of mass gathering industries. There's more of them than we thought when this all happened. And taking care of them is proving to be, you know, one of the most important things I think we can do.
And I'll just correct you, Patrick, but there's just a slip of the tongue. You said Abacus instead of Unison, who are the recipients of the $2 million from Minister McLeod. Yes. I know we both got Abacus on the brain, obviously. David, so three things. What do we want in the live music industry? And again, I'd like to sort of make it very clear that we represent the industry side. So, you know, venues, clubs, arenas, theaters, agents, managers, the supply chain, the trucking company, the sound tech, like the people who make a show go. We have three specific asks that we're hoping to see in the budget. And one is that sector specific, what we're calling a phase three. So $25 million sector specific amount of money. We saw, I need to just unpack that very quickly so it makes sense. In the beginning of the $500 million that went to Canadian Heritage and for Minister Guilbeault's portfolio, that's an emergency relief. There was a phase one and a phase two. The phase one went to the usual suspects, the clientele of the department, the people and organizations and companies that had that pre-existing program relationship. And then there was a phase two. And in the beginning, there weren't either. There was like just a mad sort of rush to figure it all out. And I would agree with Patrick. I think that a lot of people, well, I think I know a lot of people worked extremely hard on the government side to try and figure out and get the money to the right folks as fast as possible. And they did a really good job. And the phase two was a sort of, a complemented phase one. We became incredibly clear around June that the live music sector was going to be devastated. And so that phase two money materialized. It ended up being $23 million, and it made a huge impact. And in fact, didn't just make an impact, it saved a lot of companies, organizations. So let's fast forward to today. We're looking for something that it's a phrase that I coined. This is not government talking about a phase three, it's Aaron Benjamin talking about a phase three, but just to make it easy to understand, we would like to see a phase three of $25 million, just to protect that initial investment and to try and get us to that invisible finish line, because we know how, some companies, even with small amounts, were able to make it last months and months, right? It really had a very meaningful impact. And then, of course, extension to both the wage subsidy and the rent relief programs, which are fundamental to the industry, are as many others in the hardest hit sectors. So far there've been different amounts of money to most recently through the fall economic statement, we heard about an additional $40 million that was being flowed to Heritage, and they're actually different buckets, but just to stay high level, there was some money set aside for the live music industry to engage in live streaming. And that was a mechanism through which the industry could help flow money again to that supply chain. And of course, very problematic when we're not allowed to live stream. And if we have time, maybe we can get to that, but I'll save it for now. In the future, though, one of the most important things that I hope we will have is a really robust, meaningful, clear relationship with the Canadian government. Because in advance of the pandemic, the Canadian Live Music Association represents both for and not-for-profit companies. And the not-for-profit companies are those usual suspects that have you know, not always a perfect relationship, but at least have access to pre-existing programs. It's the for-profit companies, the small ones that were much lesser known to the department and through the phase two experience, these relationships are being built. They're fundamental, it's fundamental that they grow and be fostered and nurtured so that in the sort of the wake of this, we can take stock of what kind of cultural infrastructure we have left and how to quickly address gaps, barriers, and challenges that will persist post whenever the capital O of VER is coming on. And that the breadth of the live music industry, and I don't just mean like the for-profit venues, I mean the supply chain, can have a direct relationship with the federal government to access support to rebuild so that we can truly become that what we were and beyond post-pandemic, because so many of these companies are deeply and intrinsically linked.
Thanks for that. I just want to maybe wrap up our conversation by looking, I know you're dealing day to day and it's hard for you to even imagine a year from now, but let's try to do that, because I think as Minister Freeland, as the federal government, as provincial governments start to hopefully transition away from dealing with the emergency of this pandemic and getting everybody vaccinated to how do we recover from this? I can't help but think there's different frames by which people are debating the kind of recovery we want. We've heard, you know, green recovery, a recovery focused on helping women who the data clearly shows have been disproportionately affected by this pandemic. But I don't hear as often, or if at all, a recovery around, you know, our cultural fabric, you know, all those, whether it's sports, whether it's music, whether it's art, all of them have been deeply affected by this, and they're so important in our lives. How do you, you know, sort of see and frame the conversation in terms of, I guess, convincing not just the public, but policymakers that a cultural lens needs to be critical? Because frankly, this is my own opinion, taking off my pollster hat for a minute, I don't want to live in a strong economy if I can't, you know, do all of those things that brought joy. And a lot of that was, you know, music and entertainment and restaurants and all that great stuff that made life worth living. How do you push government to see the value of that when it's not obvious, it's not often apparent in policy analysis? It's a hard question, and I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, well, I'll jump in just and try to be brief. I mean, it's something I've spent almost my entire career doing, and the pandemic's just exacerbated that, but also like highlighted some real opportunity and potential to finally answer this great question that you've asked. I mean, I think it goes back to those relationships. I mean, I've said this so many times in the last many months, like we've consumed more cultural content and especially live music than in the history of ever. I mean, even my mom is watching several live streams a day, like from wherever. And, you know, getting to know artists that she's always loved, or she has this access that she's never had before. And these are great things, but they remind us how important that the small amount of space that we have, or, you know, maybe people have more time than I do, but like to consume and to engage and to reflect and to embrace and to have this cultural content to help us through this. I think we've made the point that without it, you know, I shudder to think where we would be, right? So we have to keep building these relationships and maybe sort of get over the mythology that arts and culture have had in this country for decades. And I think cultural policy, and maybe this is another podcast with you another day, David, but 60 years of cultural policy in this country has really set a tone that we need to rethink, reframe, and among many things this pandemic has given us, I think, is that opportunity to say, did we get it right? What did we miss? It's pretty clear some of the relationships that we didn't have that we needed to have if we really start to unpack all of those, the challenges that they've been presented to us through this pandemic and rebuild things in the, you know, with this vision of, it doesn't have to be utopia, but it could certainly be better than it was. And I think that's a great starting point. I mean, so many pieces of the puzzle are so vulnerable right now. And I think that, you know, bottom line is building relationships, rebuilding where necessary, and recognizing, I guess, finally, that the consumption of cultural content defines who we are as Canadians and is fundamental to our experience in this country.
Patrick, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the recovery needs to be, we need to be watchful. I think we need to be as aware in recovery as we were in March of last year, right? That we need to be thinking about, you know, in the restaurant world, if it's just the 7 restaurants that everybody really missed and everybody flows back to those places, but not to your, you know, your local favorite or whatever, that's going to be a problem. For music, that means folks like Music Canada and CLMA continuing to work together, to continue to have group phone calls with SEMA, to continue to have questions and make questions of venues and artists and make sure that there's opening acts and all these things that people have spent a year sort of worried about in terms of, you know, return anxiety. I think that feeling of going and checking on your neighbor that we sort of had last April is as important as the clouds begin to break as they were as when they rolled in.
Well, on that very positive note, which I appreciate us ending, thank you to both of you. I think, you know, I am hopeful. I think there's plenty of data that, whether it's the polling we did, Patrick, or the economic data that comes out, that there is this this pent up demand of consumers who want to go and consume live music again. It's just a matter of finding that moment when it's safe to do it, I think is going to be, and making sure that these venues and these artists and everyone who supports that sector is there when we're ready to come back, I think is really the goal. So I'm not just saying this because I know you so well. I think you have both, you know, been such fighters for your sector. So congrats and, you know, thank you. And keep up the good fight. I hope next Monday, when we're recording this on a Monday, a week from now is budget day, I hope you get what you need, because I certainly want live music to be around for a long, long time. So thank you to both of you for joining.
Thank you so much, David. It's just such a treat to chat with you. Nice break in my day. Thank you.
Thanks so much, David. And thanks, Aaron.
See you, Patrick. Thank you.